This is American Dissident Voices. This is a program speaking for Americans who believe in freedom rather than in political correctness, who value quality above equality, and are willing to do whatever must be done to restore America to racial and moral health and her public institutions to sanity and integrity. This is a program speaking for Americans who dissent from the United States government's policies of multiculturalism and enforced diversity and globalism. This program is the voice of America's dissidents who are speaking out to America's patriots and to patriots of our Western civilization around the world in order that we may learn together and work together for a better future for us all.
Today, we continue our interview with Mark Weber, director of the Institute for Historical Review. We'll look at Ernst Zundel's legacy of freedom, and we'll explore the potential positive consequences of Jewish arrogance and miscalculation in this changing world. American Dissident Voices. Well, I'll say this. If the Jewish power structure wanted to silence Ernst Zundel, they have utterly failed. Because of their persecution of this gentle man, they've brought his ideas to millions of people who might never have heard of him before.
Well, that's one of the, even some people who hate Ernst Zundel have been a little surprised that here he was basically living rather quietly in Tennessee. He's arrested in February, and especially in the first months after his arrest, the Zundel case was front page news in newspapers all across Canada and on national television and radio. I was interviewed for national radio and television in that regard myself. But it became people had more or less forgotten, I mean, to some degree, about Ernst Zundel because he had moved to the United States. He was not really in the headlines very much. And suddenly the thing was a big story again. And since his arrest, of course, there continues to be played up by those people who insist that this injustice has to be known. Indeed, if he were arrested, deported to Germany and held there, it could well turn out that that could lead to yet another explosion of activity and interest in the case over in Europe, where the Zundel case is not so well known. Now, of course, that's not something we look forward to or want, but it's similar to what's happening around the world. The more Ariel Sharon tries to stamp out the opposition, the resistance to the occupation by the Palestinians, the more the resistance seems to grow.
And the more oppression and injustice that the Jewish establishment rains down upon Ernst Zundel's head, the more people will look upon Ernst Zundel's ideas with an open mind.
Well, it's also a parallel too with the efforts by these same organizations to silence or suppress the Mel Gibson film. That again failed, and the film is certainly one of the most successful motion pictures of the time right now. But the anger and fury and hatred against Gibson that was came out before and during and continues to come out because of the film has actually had the effect of increasing interest by people who normally would not perhaps have been so interested in the film and to see it.
Well, not only are more people seeing the film, but they're going there with a very sharpened awareness of the Jewish question surrounding the actions portrayed 2,000 years ago and their parallels in the modern world.
That's quite true. And it's really crazy, I think. I mean, just shows a tremendous misperception by Jewish groups to think that because that film was shown that would lead to some sort of violence. I mean, the film's been out now more than a month. And as far as I know, there's not one reported case of any Jewish person being physically hurt or attacked because of the film. But what has happened, and even some Jewish writers have noted this with alarm, millions of people are outraged not because of what is depicted in the film, but because of the behavior of Jewish groups in the past year to denigrate and suppress the film.
It seems they've gotten precisely the opposite results that they wanted from their campaign.
Well, I think it shows really just a real miscalculation about the mentality of people they're dealing with. But it's a pattern, as I've said many times, it's repeated itself over and over in history. It's when people get powerful and arrogant, they become reckless and they miscalculate, and that's what's happening again in this case.
Well, to me, that's encouraging. Can you tell me what you've been doing to bring the Zundel case to a wider audience?
Well, shortly after Ernst was arrested, his wife, Ingrid, called me, and she had consulted with Ernst about this as well, and she asked me to deal with the flood, really, at that time, of requests for interviews and so forth that were coming out, and I readily agreed. I've known Ernst for years. I've testified in a couple of his cases, and I've written a lot about him, and we've welcomed him as a speaker at our conferences. And so I readily agreed, of course. And as a result of that, there was been many, many interviews and guest appearances over the past year relating to the Zundel case. Now, most of them, on the highest profile of these, were in the weeks immediately after his arrest, when this was a big case in Canada, as I mentioned earlier. Over the past year, I've continued to appear on a lot of radio and television and in print too, in interviews and for print journalists as well, playing up this, trying to keep up interest in the case. And I've been very gratified by how many, especially independent radio stations and talk show hosts and so forth, have picked up on this. Just the other week, I did another interview on the Jeff Rentz show, which is a broadcast on the, I think it's called the Talk Radio Network, and also online as well. Now, again, he's a person who reaches mainly a listenership very different than what American Dissident Voices does.
It's sort of a new age type of radio show.
A new age thing, and he deals with hell things and lots of sort of alternative views of the world and culture and so forth. But he has really picked up the ball on the Zundel case, and he says this is an outrage. He's very concerned about the erosion of freedoms in our society, and rightly so.
Was Mrs. Zundel also a guest on his show?
He was on the very first time that he did an interview on this. She was on, and I was on as well. That was just very shortly after the arrest. But since then, she has not been on his show. Now, I've been on, I think, six times now.
Well, I'm going to have you on more often, so he doesn't pass me in the Mark Weber interview department.
Well, thank you.
What does it tell you, Mark, that Mr. Rentz is willing to cordially discuss Mr. Zundel and some of his revisionist concepts? And that mainstream station owners who carry his show are happy to have that kind of programming on their airwaves.
He has suffered as a result. There have been threats of boycotts and withdrawal of advertising. I mean, this is a pretty major show and has substantial advertisers. I mean, that's one of the features of his show as opposed to American Dissident Voices, that it's interrupted repeatedly with ads for this, that, and the other thing. He's determined to stick it out anyway. It reminds me, for example, of the company, I guess, in Florida that rents out billboard space and came under pressure because of the National Alliance billboard that appeared down there. And I think we're going to see more of that in the years ahead. Now, again, Rentz is a little more independent than others, so he can afford to stick his neck out a little further than some other people might. But there'll be more people like this, I'm sure, in the years ahead.
So you think we are seeing something of a loosening of Jewish enforced political correctness?
I think that's happening all over the world. This is America is the great bastion of Jewish power, and I've repeatedly referred to it. But in October, the Prime Minister of Malaysia said, I mean, Jews are so powerful, they've seized, they're able to rule the world through proxy, practically. I mean, that, and especially through the United States, and to get other people to fight and die and kill for them. Now, perhaps it's overstated, but the essential truth of what he said is, I think, more and more apparent to everyone. Now, America, this is the country where it's going to be most difficult, because this is the great bastion of Jewish power. A few weeks ago, I sort of slipped in with someone else to an AIPAC meeting, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee.
Really?
Yeah, it was at a large synagogue in Newport Beach, and it was publicly announced, and it wasn't restricted to Jews, although there were very, very few non-Jews there. And there were maybe 900, that's what they said, 900 Jews from the Newport Beach area, California. Now, this is a very wealthy area that down there, and this was at a large synagogue, and there was one of the main speakers was the congressman for the area, Chris Cox, who gave a sort of report on what he's doing to help their interests. But the meeting is very useful. It's very valuable to come to a meeting like that, because what it does is reinforce, you may know this and I may know this, but it's hard for most non-Jews to realize just how determined, how focused Jews are in the United States to support their interests. I mean, this is in a synagogue, but it certainly didn't have anything to do with God or religion in the sense that most people think of it. This was a meeting about power and how to hold on to it. But one of the points that was made over and over in this rally, really, is a better word for it, is that the United States is the last country in the world, really, that supports Israel. This is the bastion. It's the only real bastion of support left. Now, the point that was made was to say, for that reason, it's all the more important to give money to AIPAC, which is the central Jewish lobbying institution, or is pro-Israel lobbying institution in Washington, D.C., to keep U.S. congressmen herded in and inside the corral and not causing any trouble. Because without that support, Israel's really doomed. I mean, this is a country that, without this constant, continual influx of support in money and weaponry and diplomatic support from the United States, its days, I think, would be numbered. And this was a major theme of that meeting. And it's really remarkable, I think, and especially for non-Jews, to ever even read about meetings like that, because I think they sort of think that a synagogue is something like a church, and that people are praying for world peace, or perhaps they're praying because somebody's going to have an operation, or they're praying to lead good lives. Well, at this synagogue, wasn't anything about that. This was all about power and group interests, and that was the whole point. And when one group is that determined and that focused, it's much, much easier for it when everyone else are just sort of worrying about their own individual private concerns.
Were you allowed to introduce yourself and ask a few questions?
I was hoping that nobody might recognize me, because there could be a little embarrassment there if I had been perhaps recognized. No, there were a few non-Jews, but overwhelmingly, I mean, I'd say, you know, 98%, it was a Jewish meeting. It wasn't a private meeting. It was announced in the newspaper.
Right.
Where I went. And I was mainly interested to see also, I didn't realize how extensive a meeting it would be, but I was interested to see how the congressman here would speak to these people.
Well, very interesting analysis. Perhaps you're going to write something about the meeting.
Well, I think I will. I've written up already something about it, and I'll probably fine-tune it and send it out.
In last week's Toronto Star, we saw an editorial by a Jewish attorney, Alan Young, which might be viewed as the polar opposite of the editorial you mentioned in the Globe and Mail. First, Young invokes the National Alliance, William Pierce, Jim Keekstra, and Ernst Zundel as examples of haters. And then he goes on to openly advocate torture and Clockwork Orange-style mental reprogramming for haters. If you'll allow me, just let me quote a portion of this incredible editorial, and then I'll ask for your comments on it. This is Alan Young, Jewish attorney. Quote, It is bizarre that criminal justice officials try to do more to change the belief and behavior of Johns charged with prostitution than they do with the Ernst Zundels and Jim Keegstras of the world. Just as some cancers require invasive surgery, the hate crime needs intrusive measures. The usual out-of-sight, out-of-mind approach to modern punishment just won't work in this case. For crimes of supreme stupidity, we need clockwork orange justice. Strapping the hate criminal into a chair for an interminable period and keeping his eyes wide open with metal clamps so he cannot escape from an onslaught of cinematic imagery carefully designed to break his neurotic attachment to self-induced intellectual impairment. In the context of hate crime, I do have some regrets that we have a constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. I don't think coercive persuasion or deprogramming is necessarily cruel, but as a state sanction, it is unusual. However, if the crime is unique, the sanction should be also. Simply dishing out more prison time or a larger fine is a dead end. We need a punishment that can kickstart a brain. Close quote. What do you have to say to that, Mark?
Well, I think this is very valuable. And again, people ought to remember this. This shows really the kind of mentality that people like Alan Young and Jewish leaders generally have of non-Jews. They view non-Jews as essentially sort of stupid and have to be sort of guided along because they might start getting the wrong idea. Because something like that mentality is already operating in society, not in the narrow sense that he says it, but this constant reiteration in our society of this Holocaust story is designed to do the same thing. That is, make non-Jews believe that whatever Jews basically want should be approved because they're so altruistic and noble and innocent and defenseless that saying no to anything that Jewish groups want is just almost a crime. It's a terrible thing. And Americans are fed just an enormous amount of propaganda to bolster that image. But it shows something else, too. It shows that those people who oppose Jewish power and Jewish intrigues are regarded as just mentally sick. Now, this gets to a real central question, and one that people have tried to deal with throughout the ages. Why does this perpetual thing called the Jewish question keep recurring? Or to put it another way, why does anti-Semitism exist? Now, of course, it's a stupid term, it's a misnomer, it's a not a very good one, but why does this phenomenon exist? Now, Eli Wiesel, he says, his explanation for it is, it's just a mystery. It's like some virus in the air that somehow a bug that people get and for no good reason, and suddenly there's this big problem. Well, that's just absurd. That's just it's a complete negation of reality of human how human beings act and how history is. To his credit, and I've cited this, Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, wrote in his book The Jewish State, which is the seminal, central kind of manifesto, you might say, of modern Zionism. He deals with this question. He says that anti-Semitism exists as a perfectly understandable and natural reaction of non-Jews to the fact that Jews in the societies in which they live regard themselves as a separate people, and yet they push interests that are contrary to those of the people among whom they live. And he says it's absolutely understandable that non-Jews are going to be infuriated and angry about this eventually.
That's common sense.
It's just common sense. And so Herzl's solution to this problem, he says, is for Jews to give up living among non-Jews and go live in a separate country of their own and become what he calls a normal people. Well, it hasn't worked that way, but that's his solution. But the point is that at least he has some rational, sensible analysis of this problem. And Alan Young, this Jewish attorney you're quoting, for him, this is just inexplicable because he's unable, completely unable, to see things from the point of view of non-Jews. It's like, why should the Jews be surprised, for example, if Frenchmen want to keep France as French as Jews want to keep Israel Jewish? It's a perfectly understandable phenomenon that Japanese want to keep Japan Japanese, French want to keep France French, and so on and so forth. Whatever people want to keep, they have some loyalties to their heritage and their culture and so forth. That's perfectly understandable. And of course, Jews insist upon it for themselves. But they seem incapable of understanding that non-Jews can have exactly the same sentiments and feelings, and that they don't like it when a group that's not of their own come in and take huge amounts of power and push the cultural and political agenda of the society in a way that's contrary to the feelings and interests of the people.
I was just astounded in the editorial by his attitude that those who disagree, who have a different point of view, are to be treated in an inhumane, they're going to be tortured until they submit, until they change their minds. It's just astounding to me.
Yeah, it is. It is astonishing. And again, it's just, this phenomenon is explored really in some detail in the books by Professor Kevin MacDonald, in the three books that he's written on Judaism and Jewish behavior throughout history. And he talks in there over and over of a kind of myopia, a misperception the Jews have about not only themselves and their relationship to non-Jews, but how non-Jews are as well. And we see this over and over in a kind of overreaching and arrogance, and we're seeing it again now around the world. One of the things that's just bizarre and very difficult, I think, for non-Jews to understand is that, and you see this in the Old Testament, and you see it in Jewish movies and books and so forth, they regard the tremendous hostility toward them that has erupted time and time again in the past not as any reflection of anything bad on their part, but as a fact, in fact, as a confirmation of how good they are. You'll see this in the Old Testament. It's in the book of Genesis and talking about the Jews in Egypt. You'll find it in the book of Esther about the Jews in Babylon. This persecution is just further evidence for many Jews of Jewish nobility and chosenness and greatness. Now, many other people would step back and say, well, maybe there's some relationship between the way Jews act and what people think of Jews. But for Jews, this isn't overwhelming. This isn't how they look at it. There's almost a kind of perverse pride in looking and saying, well, they hate us, because that hatred isn't regarded as something, it's a kind of badge of distinction or a badge of honor.
What do you think of the idea that the climax, the peak of Jewish power, sometimes precedes an awakening of people to that power?
Well, there was a time that I thought that the apex, the high point, had already been reached. I thought it was perhaps even back about 23 years ago when Nixon was president. There was this is during the 1973 war. But I've been amazed that just when I thought it couldn't get any worse, or it continues to go that way. And it's now increasingly obvious, I think, that the American government is willing more and more blatantly than ever to betray and jeopardize not only the interests of humanity, but American interests in this mad alliance with Israel. And we see this just every passing, more and more vividly with each passing week. Increasingly, it's clear to the world, and should be more clear to Americans, that the United States and Israel are virtually alone. There's no real strong support for this crazy alliance. But when American politicians say they're committed to Israel, they're going to guarantee Israel's existence, Americans should pay close attention, because the implications of that are that they'll spend just countless of billions of dollars and expend many, many more American lives for this crazy alliance. And that's more and more obvious. So but I've been a surprised that it's been pushed this far.
Which way are we going in this country? Is Jewish arrogance going to have even more of a field day with the Constitution than they already have, trashing our rights, jailing dissidents, or have they overplayed their hand?
That's, you know, hard to say, but there was an amazing piece just the other day in the Los Angeles Times analyzing how Rumsfeld is making plans for a military government in the United States to take over in case of a big terrorist attack that would supposedly paralyze our political structure. I mean, that's a dangerous thing. And I remember William Pierce predicted that things were going to get a lot worse before they were going to get any better. And I've been amazed at how prescient, how far-sighted his predictions turned out to be. I mean, a year before the 9/11 attack, William Pierce wrote a piece in which he predicted, rather amazingly, that there could very well be an attack on the World Trade Center. I think he wrote, well, if you're walking around down lower Manhattan in New York, better wear a hard hat, because the World Trade Center, this big symbol of American financial power, could very well be attacked.
He also gave a general warning, stay out of tall buildings.
Out of tall buildings. I mean, that's pretty amazing. The Bush administration officials had listened to Pierce more than someone else, they might have done something to prevent the 9/11 attack.
Well, as long as we have our freedom of speech, let's keep pressing for a greater awareness among our people, and hopefully that will bring a change in the world, a change for the better. And I thank you, Mark, for all you're doing and all the Institute for Historical Review is doing to bring reason and truth to the people. And I thank you for being our guest on American Dissident Voices.
Well, thank you again, Kevin. All the best to you.
You have been listening to a presentation of American Dissident Voices. The program was sponsored as a public service by National Vanguard Books, America's foremost supplier of patriotic books and tapes. You may purchase a high-fidelity audio recording of this program or any earlier program for $12.95 postpaid. In ordering program tapes, be sure to mention the date and the subject of the program and the call letters of this radio station. For $2, we'll send you our newest 72-page illustrated catalog with descriptions and ordering information for more than 600 books and tapes of interest to patriots. Many of the items in the National Vanguard Books catalog are available nowhere else. Our mailing address is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Please write that address down now, because you may not hear this program again on this station. The forces of political correctness do not believe in free speech, and they do not like this program. Our address again is National Vanguard Books, Post Office Box 90, that's 90, Hillsboro, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA. Visit us on the internet at www.natvan.com. That's spelled NATVAN.com. Or www.natall.com. That's spelled NATALL.com. These American Dissident Voices programs are sponsored by donations from listeners like yourself. Please send a donation today to help us keep these programs on the air. This program is pre-recorded and comes to you from the United States of America.